Port Leisure, the morning of July the 13th, as members of the Irish Veteran and Vintage Car Club prepare for the first Gordon Bennett commemoration rally, which is about to begin.
I have to prime the engine with petrol. What is that? Just flood your carburetor. And hope she'll start. That's all you can say when you have a 1901 car. Hope you'll start. They often start a lot better than the latest type cars you have.
Ozzie Bennett, setting off on his 1901 de Dion Bouton. The object of the rally was to cover the original circuit, forming a rough triangle of the towns Port Leisure, Carlow and Kilcullen, and enthusiasts from all over the country have gathered to take part.
This is the fifth oldest standard in existence, and it's the oldest closed standard. Well, the thing that's unusual about this car, it was supposed to belong to the Pankhurst family, the Suffragettes in England. We bought it at the sword sale in Scotland about 10 years ago. It's a six-cylinder car. British Leyland, I think, still have the original standard, which is on the same chassis as this one.
It's a 1911 Clement Talbot. We have it about 10 years.
Well, it's a twin-cylinder Renault, 10-14 horsepower, 1904. It was originally came from France. It wasn't an Irish car. And I believe took part in a very early Monte Carlo rally. It's the only one of its type known to exist. It's a big twin, which is very rare. And the body is entirely made of wood. Most of the car is original, except the mudguards and the bonnet.
In 1901, Arl Johnson, made in Scotland. It's a three-seater, and the driver sits in the middle row of seats, and the front passengers have no protection in front of them at all whatsoever. And then the back passengers sit back-to-back, like a back-to-back car, kind of the next step up from a horse carriage. And when they designed this, they reckoned that the design of cars wouldn't change radically for over the next 20, 30 years, like horse-drawn vehicles didn't change over the last 100 years.
This rally commemorates the fact that 71 years ago, in 1903, the world's eyes turned to Ireland, where the newly discovered sport of motor racing was staging its greatest prize, the Gordon Bennett Trophy. Frank Cassidy.
You see, the Gordon Bennett race, as such, was to my mind, and to a lot of people's mind, was the most famous race ever held since or before. But nothing very much was done about it. But this year now we have started the annual Gordon Bennett commemoration race, or rally, and we hope that it's going to build into something very, very big.
The Gordon Bennett race took its name from James Gordon Bennett, owner and publisher of the New York Herald, the man who sent Henry Morton Stanley in search of Dr. Livingstone. Shortly after the success of that epic African adventure, Gordon Bennett moved to Paris, where he published a Paris and London edition of his paper. And, as another promotional exercise for the New York Herald, Gordon Bennett turned his attention to the latest craze in France, motor racing, and in 1899 he presented a trophy, the Coupe Internationale, to the Automobile Club de France for an annual international motor race. The rules of the race stated,
"The cars were to weigh under 1,000 kilograms each, about 1 ton. The course would not be less than 344 or more than 416 miles. The race to be held between May 15th and August 15th each year, by the country which won the previous race, or failing that, in France. Any recognised club could enter three cars to represent its country."
But it was the fifth and final rule which caused most trouble.
"Every car competing must have been constructed throughout, and as regards every part in the country of its origin."
The first and second Gordon Bennett races were won by France, but in 1902 an Englishman, glorying in the name Selwyn Francis Edge, driving a Napier for England, won the race from Paris to Innsbruck. This meant that the race of 1903 would be staged on English soil. The followers of motoring in England knew that this was not possible, as motor racing was still illegal on the public roads, and hostility against the car was still very strong in 1902. The Automobile Club of England was about to hand back the staging of the 1903 race to France when a compromise was suggested by an Irishman, R.J. MacCready, editor of the Irish motoring magazine, The Motor News, namely, that the race be held in Ireland. The Light Locomotives Ireland Bill was introduced into Parliament by John Scott Montagu, which exempted the competing cars from any speed limit on the day of the race, and absolved the county councils from any expenses spent on road improvements. The bill was supported by all the Irish members and most other MPs, and was through the Commons in a record 7 days after its first reading. The Automobile Club, to win over any opposition which might exist, canvassed hoteliers, newspapers, MPs, Irish peers, railway companies, county councils, mayors, and even clerics. In turn, a circular was sent by the bishops in the area to be read in all churches. Father Dunney, a native of Ardskull, now 93 years old, remembers this letter.
Well, in more cases, a man called Dr. Foley was a man. Kildare and Loughlin. And in Dublin, it was Archbishop Welsh. The priest got orders to speak from the altar upon the previous Sunday and tell the people to keep off the roads, you know. And that was done every place.
As a gesture to Ireland's willingness to stage the race, Count Zaborowski proposed to the Automobile Club of Great Britain that England's racing cars should adopt Ireland's national colour green as their emblem. And so, British racing green, used on the English cars in 1903, is the colour still used on British racing cars today. As soon as Parliament had passed the new law and support for the race was evident in Ireland, the Automobile Club sent its representatives, Claude Johnson and Count Zaborowski, to Ireland to find a suitable circuit for the race. 5 possible routes for the race were found and examined. The course finally selected was a figure of 8 circuit, running from Naas to Kilcullen, down the Carlow Road to Carlow, turning back to Athy and Naas, then down the main Cork Road, through Kildare and Monasterevin, turning at Maryborough, now Port Leisha, to Stradbally, Athy, and back to Naas. This circuit was later amended, leaving out Naas and travelling across the Curragh instead. Thus, 2 circuits were involved, the longer being over 51 miles and the shorter being 40 miles. 7 laps would be covered, 6 over the short and long circuit, and the 7th over the longer distance. The final distance of the race would be 327.5 miles, but the race still needed a starting and finishing point. The Motor News.
Just 1.75 miles from the turn to Old Kilcullen, the committee decided to have the start and finish of the great race. There is a police barracks on the right, and on the left, the grounds of Ballyshannon House, where it is intended to erect the grandstand.
The grandstand at Ballyshannon was a huge structure, crossing the road so the cars could drive underneath. The stand was to hold 1,000 people, who would pay £2 each into the enclosure and stand. Bookings for this stand were taken by Thomas Cook, the company of travel agents. The grandstand enclosure consisted of a tent city, providing sleeping accommodation for hundreds of people, and a specially erected telegraph centre where journalists could flash the progress of the race to their papers all over the world. James O'Rourke of Ballyshannon was 17 years old when the enclosure area was being built.
Well, I remember seeing the stand. I was up on the building. It was about 0.5 mile or so from Ballyshannon Cross, and it was right across the road, from one side of the road to the other. Oh, it was 5 perch wide, like, they were at this bridge. Oh, I'd say they were nearly 2 months. There was terrible yelders going up, you know, but to keep the crowd up and big planks across the road. It was a terrible stretch. It was from here, you know. So the road now was way down there, and it was from here to the house beyond. I seen the timber going down and seen them taking it down. Well, then up along the road for about 1 mile, it was sort of a hill like, and high land over the ditches. Well, then people had stands there that they built themselves like for the day. Like, you could see the road now down to a highway called the Motor Art School. You'd see the road now, we'll say, for I 4 mile away you, and they'd see them coming. Of course, I couldn't get down there. They wouldn't let you down. They wouldn't let you out in the road, you see. No, you had to stay in the yard where you were. You see, you couldn't go to the road at all. No trapping on the road at all.
One account of the time estimated that 7,000 officials were used for stewarding. 3,000 constables of the Royal Irish Constabulary were drafted into the area to control the crowds. Father Dunny saw the race at his home at the Moat of Ard Scull.
Every county in Ireland had to send a quarter of their force to guard the race. There must have been 500 policemen there. And they were the constabulary, the RIC. There were about 30 policemen staying at our place. There were the police from one particular county. I think it was Sligo. Stayed out in the farm buildings. I was a farming stock, you see. And they stayed out on the lofts. There were a number of lofts, you see, and barns. And there was straw put there for them, and they slept there. I don't know whether they were there for 2 or 3 days, you see. They came the day before the race, and they went away the day after the race.
2 large squads of police were stationed at Ballyshannon. James O'Rourke again.
The constabulary men was on the road. They were sleeping in a barn down here in Ballyshannon. Hoonies was the name. James Hoonies. And they had a it was a cattle house, you see. The cattle was under it and horses. It was a big, long barn. There was straw, oaten straw, put on the floor, and they all lay on it. They come there that night. I'd say there'd be about nearly 40 of them. Over 40, I think. And the sergeant come up. I think his name was Wilson. Sergeant Wilson. And there was no one around, and he came up to me, mother, and wanted to know would you go down and do the cooking.
Another man in Ballyshannon whose family had police billeted with them was Tighe Byrne.
A man from the depot in the Phoenix Park came down here to know if we could put up the police for them on a big corn loft we have. So they put up a tent in the field outside the house and they slept on this loft. We have. And Head Constable English was the man in charge of the police, and he stayed in the house that night. They were here for a couple of days, you see, before the thing. And then they dispersed from here along the route, you know. Well, 60 police were here altogether, I'd say.
The Treasury footed the £1,200 bill which the county councils had spent improving the roads for the race. Father Dunny.
The roads were all prepared and tarmacadamed and all to that. The whole roads were done up for the fortnight before the race and rolled in, you see, and made perfectly level. And there was no such thing as holes in the road at the time. Where the trees overhung the road or the hedges were too wide, they cut in order to give the people a chance of seeing the race.
Joseph Melia remembers the work done on the roads at his home in Monasterevin.
Well, I may tell you, the roads have improved so much. They're like a slate now along here. And that time, they raked the big stones over to put light gravel on it for the cars. So you see the change come now. It's now the time they should have the motor race on it. That time they're all hand-broken stones. And they raked them, you see, one side. And they put this gravel up and down. You know what gravel is, here and there. I remember that all right. We were saying that wouldn't last long, the iron wheels, that time, and horses and cars.
One of the greatest problems on the roads was dust. The answer was found in a newly developed chemical, Westromite. Barrels of the chemical were imported from the manufacturers Beerholm and Van Westrum and sprayed on the roads by the county councils. The chemical was reported to be a complete success. As the time for the race drew near, arrangements went ahead, and the Automobile Club decided to make the race part of an event to be called the Irish Fortnight, the Gordon Bennett part of the event to be the main attraction. The other events would include speed trials for cars and motorcycles at the Phoenix Park, a garden party at the Viceregal Lodge, a motor tour from Dublin to Belfast, and a motorboat race on July the 11th in Cork for the Alfred Harmsworth Cup. The French railway companies laid on special excursions to Ireland. The City of Dublin Steam Packet Company advertised London to Dublin in 9 1/4 hours. Special fares for steamers on the Liverpool-Dublin route were quoted, deck 6 3 return, cabin 21 shillings. Motor cars conveyed for 36 shillings return. One person who cashed in on the interest in the race was a young Irish writer living in Paris, James Joyce. Under the name of a special Paris correspondent, he sent an interview with one of the French driving team, Henri Fournier, to the Irish Times. Another Irish artist who had a connection with the 1903 race was songwriter Percy French. After the Gordon Bennett race of 1902, Percy French wrote Jim Whelan's Automobile.
Jim Whelan's ghost took a turn round the coast on the day of the Malta car race, and the wind being fair, he was whooshed through the air at a rate even Edge dared in face. When the winner came up to receive the great cup, his anger he could not conceal, for there at the post was Jim Whelan's ghost with 3/4 of his automobile.
7 control points were used. These controls to be at Old Kilcullen, Kildare, Monasterevin, Stradbally, Athy, Castledermot and Carlow. Each car had to stop at the control points for a period of 7 minutes, thus eliminating overtaking on the narrow roads. The winner would be decided by the clock, the car covering the complete course in the shortest time. The week before the race, excitement built up to a climax. A Gordon Bennett inquiry office opened at 11 Lower Sackville Street. Over 100 journalists arrived to cover the race. Motorists arrived after journeys over land and sea from as far away as Budapest and Madrid. The Automobile Club set up its race headquarters in the Shelburne Hotel, Dublin. The Biograph Studio, a film company, obtained special permission to make a film of the race, which could be seen in the American Biograph Cinema, Dublin, the day after the race. The film, held today in the National Library, was one of the first newsreels filmed in Ireland. Even the Dublin Stock Exchange closed on the day of the race. Motoring Illustrated sent 16 reporters to cover the event and established a record by publishing a special edition of the magazine in Dublin only 12 hours after the race ended. Among the celebrities who arrived were His Royal Highness the Prince of Hohenlohe, Baron Henri de Rothschild, and a Spanish Duke and Duchess who booked a suite at John Malek's hotel on the Curragh. Many visitors complained of the outrageous prices being charged by hoteliers, business people and farmers, a complaint which is denied by Father Dunny.
It didn't.
My place, anyway, in a place called Moat Lodge, we put them all up. We gave them straw, you see, and we supplied them with milk for their tea, you see, and they did their own catering, but we'd give them milk, you see. But that was all. I didn't hear of that at all. I can only speak about my own place. I know there was no charge whatever paid to us anyway. None whatever.
Nevertheless, at a time when the average man earned 30 shillings to £2 a week, magazines gave these examples of prices.
A 4-mile ride in a jaunting car, 10 shillings. A glass of water, 6. A wash-up at a farmyard pump, 1 shilling. A second-rate hotel room in Athy, £3 for a night. A room in a cottage near Athy, £6 for a night.
While at Kilmead near Athy, the Motor News reported this incident.
Mr. J.C. Percy was anxious to secure a field for some English friends to camp in, and was asked the sum of £20 for a single night, although he explained that he did not wish to rent the field for an entire year.
Another account of accommodation problems is given by Mary Wright, who lives near Kilcullen.
Father O'Farrell told us this. It's a true story. He was a student. As a matter of fact, he was a deacon at the time. And he was home in his own native town on a holiday, and he went out for a walk with the boys, and there was he heard ructions going on in this house, and he says, I better go over, there'll be somebody killed. So he knocked and the woman opened the door, and he says, me good woman, are you in trouble? But it's like this now, Father. I'm keeping a bit of a lodging house for this motor race. And I have penny beds and 3 halfpenny beds. And in the 3 halfpenny beds, they can lie on their back, but on the penny beds, they have to lie in their side. So here's a fella, and he only paid 1 penny. And he's lying on his back, but by God, I'll make him lie on his side.
However, the actual drivers fared a little better. The 3-man American team of Owen, Winton and Moers made Timolan Rectory near Ballytor, their base. The British team of Jarrett, Stocks and Edge stayed at Reban Castle near Athy. The German team, Genazzi, Baron de Caters and Foxhall Keane, stayed at the Leinster Arms Hotel, Athy. The French team, Fournier, Farmont and Chevalier de Nif, chartered a steamship, the Ferdinand de Lesseps, and steamed into the Alexandra docks on the Sunday morning before the race, where huge crowds were gathered to greet them. The French team caused a sensation when, 2 days before the race, Henri Fournier, the driver interviewed by James Joyce, was dropped from the team after a row with the Moors company about Fournier's connection with a rival car manufacturer. Fournier was replaced on the team by Gabriel. The Germans, too, had their problems, when 2 of the team originally picked were objected to because they were professional drivers. Herr Jelinek, the manager of the Mercedes team, insisted on picking his own drivers and proved his point by taking a non-German team to Ireland, Genazzi and Baron de Caters being Belgians, and Foxhall Keane an American. Camille Genazzi was the best-known driver of the field, for it was he who drove the first car at over 100 kilometres per hour in 1889. The German team almost missed the race, because the month before, the 390-horsepower Mercedes prepared for the race were destroyed in a fire at the factory at Cannstatt, Germany. However, the Mercedes Paris agent, Karl Lehmann, was able to borrow 3 privately owned 60-horsepower Mercedes Tourers, and these were quickly stripped and prepared for racing. One car which took part in this year's rally is identical to these. The 60-horsepower 9.2-litre engine is a formidable machine even today. Frank Smith, who brought the car from England to the rally, demonstrated that it is still capable of speeds in excess of 80 miles per hour.
Third to second. Listed. Those are oilers, those feed oil to each bearing, both big end and main, and they feed it in metered quantities because the sump is a dry sump, which means that all the oil you use goes to waste. Well, I've got used to the car a bit now, and I've had people following me and telling me what speeds I've been doing. With a smooth road and downhill and a brave man, he could probably get 90, 95.
The weigh-in was held on the day before the race at the Market Square Nace under the supervision of Mr. Warby Beaumont of the Automobile Club. As Kildare County Council hadn't a suitable weighbridge for the job,
2 small machines capable of weighing 0.5 ton were placed opposite one another. Then, 2 lengths of tramway line were adjusted on them to act as guides for the wheels of the automobiles.
Crude as this arrangement sounds, it seems to have been accurate, because when Farman's Panhard was found to be 31 pounds overweight, de Nif challenged the accuracy of the scales.
The standard weights were fetched, sinisterly enough, from the local jail, and proved to be right to a couple of ounces.
The Americans ran into trouble too when Moore's car was found to be 12 pounds too heavy. Another argument erupted when an objection was raised to the Michelin tyres on the German Mercedes. Luckily, the Germans were able to reshod their cars quickly with definitely German-made tyres, and all were satisfied. The crowds moved from the way in at Nace to the hotels and campsites around the course and prepared for an early start the next morning. The Great Southern and Great Western Railways gathered together all available rolling stock, and between midnight and early morning, 36 trains left Dublin, packed with spectators. At 6 a.m., all roads leading onto the course were closed, and the police took up positions. Two pilot cars were sent over each leg of the circuit to show that the race was about to start.
With deafening roars of their exhaust pipes, the great racers drew into line, one behind the other, and at 7:05, Mr. Edge's big Napier came up to the post. The cup holder and his mechanician settled themselves into their seats. A score of hands were thrust forward in cordial farewell. At the word 30 seconds, the two men, who, by the way, presented a picturesque appearance in their green caps and white coats, pulled down their masks. The starter leant forward to shout into the driver's ear the warning words, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. And with unsensational steadiness, the big car moved off amid a hurricane of cheers.
Genazzi seemed to make the most impressive start, for one French journalist in his magazine L'Auto dramatically wrote,
"When, with a start of vertiginous rapidity, he disappeared like a bird taking flight, one had the vision of some fantastic Satan, some Mephistopheles escaped from the imagination of Goethe, some child of German legend astride a mysterious hippogriff on the slopes of the Brocken."
This is how James O'Rourke recalls the same moment.
All those crowds there, pushing one another to get away to see that. You hear the car going, like that. And the lad, see, you only see his head. Four wheels, there's nothing else in it. And the boos of you, you hear it coming, you know, a long ways off. A boo, terrible. Oh, sure, they were all leaping to, you know, to look at it. To look at it, see the car. But sure, you'd only see it coming. We only could see, you see, coming about 500 yards, and then look up the road and you'd only see it. You said, wow, the house is in the way like that. And, of course, they went into Kilcullen first and turned to the right, and on that way, and on the Carlow Road. And there was all neighbours thinking, oh, there's no neighbours, relations, come from near and part along the road to get into the house to see them going by, you know. I wish it was great, of course. Great to see the cars. Little cars and they're sitting down. There was no car on the wheels, you know, and a little place for them to sit like. But the roars, you could hear the roars them coming, you know, half a mile away. Singing like a bee now.
A traction engine was placed on a hill about half a mile from the enclosure, and its whistle was to signal the approach of each car down the straight. Edge and Niff passed, but 14 minutes elapsed before Owen's arrival was heralded. This meant the 7-minute gap between himself and Genazzi had disappeared. Henry Norman wrote of the approach.
The whistle blew, and then, to the astonishment of all, it blew again. Immediately, and a few seconds later, two cars came flying down the hill, only about 100 yards separating them. Every spectator held his breath. The two cars passed under the grandstand, only inches separating them. A few 100 yards up the opposite slope, Owen drew onto the grass on one side, and Genazzi passed him on the grass on the other, both cars wavering alarmingly as they left the smooth road. Genazzi told us afterwards that this was his only moment of anxiety in the whole race.
Like the two going up the road now, the winner and the other lad. And they were like that when I looked out across. I could see them going up the heads, do you see? They were like that together. And their neighbours told me they'd passed them up here, up on top of the hill like there, going down into Moore.
Miss Letitia Overend of Dublin saw the race from out on the course.
Well, I remember this was a glorious day. And as we went down, somewhere near Kildare, I think, and I went to my father, and I think there were other people. We just went and sat, as anyone would, on the glass verge, you know. And then we saw several cars passed. And then someone in authority came along and said, you can't sit there any longer because it wouldn't be safe, and moved us inside a fence, inside a field, but where we could see, but not as good a place, of course. We saw them all passing. We were thrilled. It caused tremendous excitement, the whole thing did, because of the interest and the cars and the whole race itself had an immense attraction, you know. And I think it probably put it into my head and other people's to take a greater interest in motoring, you know.
Dennis Walsh of Clonegat near Monaster Evan, now 94 years old.
I drove in a horse and trap from here to Ballyshannon, and there was a load of us in it, and we stabled a horse beside the Ballyshannon, and a few person walked into the village, and then we took our positions for to see the start, and I seen the start and I seen the finish. Of course, I couldn't tell you how many was in it. There was a good few in the race. And there was one old man, an aged man. You know, he had beard. He looked for me to be an aged man. And they were sitting on a wall about 20 or 30 feet up from the village. And whatever happened, it was downhill he was coming. And he lost his eyesight, had he? Oh, there was a fly, or what happened to him, I couldn't tell you. But, and he stuck the ball right under my feet where I was sitting on. He stuck it nice and lightly. He was nearly stopped when he had the ball. He wasn't 3 minutes until he was out again, and on and off. Sure, I heard his name a thousand times, and I can't think of it now. There was no one horses, though.
The race, indeed, was not without mishap. Stocks, driving for England, mistook the road outside Castledermot and collided with a wire barrier, smashing a front wheel and putting himself out of the race. Foxhall Keane for America had the fastest first lap, averaging 52.2 miles per hour and reaching speeds of over 80 on the straights. But as a spectacle, the race proved a disappointment to some.
What a remember of the race. They were all talking about for long before it came off, and we thought it'd be a great thing, if you know what I mean. And when it actually came, we all go had the lodge above, and the great crowd watching up the Kildare Road. And after a long, long time, one car came, and it wasn't going that hard at all. And then after a long, long time, another came, the other way. But when all was over, I went across the field, didn't go down to my own house, I couldn't, and got down up the town, you know what I mean, and there wasn't a sinner up there, black or white. Not a sinner. It wasn't a bone of a day at all. There was no sport at all, of any sort. There was an oak tree here as you turned the corner, and the Germans was putting a notice up on it, you know, of their own. The person that owned it, the tree, China, that he were, gave it out to them, had to take it down. I thought that very ugly, myself. And about the shopkeeper, I won't give his name, had a draper shop and a big family, went down. And he got a big window all full of stuff, eatables, remember the description, at that time, buns and all. He never sold one, wasn't one up at all. So it was a quiet day. A very quiet day. To my mind, anyway.
But if there was little excitement at Monaster Evan, it was a different story in Athy, as Michael Bowden remembers.
Big crowds all out on the roads. They were all out around, up in trees and over here. You know, the roads were all cleared. See, to let these people out. There was no cars on the road to stop them. They had to get the road clear. They all went ahead and I them got up in the trees, they seen it all passing by. Of course, I didn't go any farther than the corner down here. All stood idle that day. The more stood idle, all the men were walking and all, the more stood idle for to see the race. And more had to stand upon the pots, so it off the roads out here, in on the pots. They called them all racing cars that time. Now the cars, it looked to be good anyway. Of course, they're all heavy, you see. And then they went to the hotel. There, they stopped there for a while. the German man. Well, he was a German man, but they couldn't see the other men too well. He was a little man about my height now, and he had a rifle scar and a red beard. And they threw him up in the man and dollied him up when he won the race at the hotel beyond. That's all. I can go by.
Michael Bowden's description of Janazze while stopped at the control in a thigh. On the second lap, all went well, until Charles Jarrett, driving his Napier for England, failed to appear. Henry Norman takes up the story.
At last a telegram arrived from Police Sergeant Brady at Stradbally, saying, Jarrett knocked out. Send surgeon at once. Apparently confirming our worst fears. The president of the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland, Sergeant Ormsby, who was medical officer to the race, was dispatched by car on back roads to Stradbally.
Jarrett and his mechanician Cecil Bianchi had been thundering down the steep hill into Stradbally at almost 80 miles per hour when suddenly his steering broke. The car veered out of control, mounted the bank, somersaulted, and crashed into another bank. Jarrett was thrown clear of the car, but Bianchi, who had strapped his wrist to the dashboard, was pinned underneath. Jarrett ran to the wreck to find Bianchi caught under the car with a red-hot exhaust pipe burning into his chest and petrol running over him from the burst petrol tank. He appealed for help from people standing close by, but they seemed rooted to the spot with sheer fright. In desperation, Jarrett lifted the huge car and held it single-handed with superhuman effort until a bystander, Joseph Dobbs of Abbey Lakes, realized what was happening and crawled in under the car, cut the strap holding Bianchi to the dashboard, and hauled him out. Jarrett and Bianchi then passed out and lay, apparently lifeless, on the road. The bystanders assumed that both men had died from their injuries and carried them into the barn of Michael Fingleton's farm nearby, where the bodies were laid out and covered with sheets. Jarrett survived, and later wrote of the crash,
"When I came to, I was in complete darkness, and for a moment thought my sight had gone. But then I found there was something covering me, and drawing it off my face, discovered that I was wrapped in a white sheet, and beside me was another white sheet. And when I called Bianchi and asked him was he dead, he replied feebly, 'I don't think I am.'"
Watching this year's commemoration rally at Stradbally was a man who saw the crash.
Sheriff was broke up coming down the rock there. I remember it well. The car must have got hold going through. He broke it up anyway. There was a lot of people now looking for parts of that car, even the latter years. You finished right at the bottom of the rock hill above. I think that here's one of the ones anyway. That must be very old. That must be very old.
Kate Connor saw the race at her home in Old Kilcullen.
I remember the cars passing the door. At intervals, you know, now and again, and all the names being shouted when they have to pass. And the only name I can ever remember is Janazze. Go on, Janazze. You know, you hear that with all the cars, but I only could remember that one. Well, after that then, I remember handing out the boiling water to the men out in the tents of the field to make their tea. And the crowds all over, everybody, the place was packed, and anyone had a room around, he said, you know, everyone was booked out. Thousands, everyone had a room to sit. Got people in, as well as the, don't you know, the tents and all around the place. But there was no standing out going, there was a standing till rush. Well, I never saw it though, I was just to hear it. There was a big sign at the house just outside my very door. And I forget what it was. It was Lager anyhow. I can remember the word Lager still, up on the big board. People were up all night, I think, don't you know. Started very early in the morning, people were up all night, sightseeing and gathering around. I never, don't even remember ever seeing a policeman. You see, I wasn't out much, because I couldn't come out. We had no protection, you know, we were just walking on the road. Just by the very door to pass. Nobody walking, free day. Everyone's leisure, all watching the race. Great day for Ireland, it was.
All day the race continued. A military band from the Curragh camp played at the grandstand. Rain fell from noon till 2 o'clock, and by late afternoon the race had been decided. Foxhall Keane had damaged the axle of his Mercedes in a skid and withdrew. All three American cars broke down, and the unlucky Baron Decatur smashed the axle of his Mercedes 10 miles from the finish line. Father Dunny.
I was a student of Maynooth at the time, And I was at the race. I was there for the preparations for the tremendous preparation for the race, you see. At certain vantage points, they erected stands, wooden stands, and charged half a crown to see the race, do you see? In four or five of these, at the motor art school, there was a very big number of stands, do you see? The contestants went over the course for the couple of days beforehand to become familiar with it, you know. Or you could see them practicing. You wouldn't know them, though, except they didn't carry anything to identify themselves. Hmm. A fellow called Janazzi, that fellow won it. And he was going with his head down, and he was going like, he was very determined to win his race. Well, Janazzi, you could see that Janazzi was winning from the start. See, they had to come the course three or four times, and Janazzi was, you could see he was leading. But I saw every car passing by the place here. Only on a very few occasions were there more than one person passing at a time. On one or two occasions, there were two cars going together. But then it was a phenomenal regard excitement at the end. There wasn't the same amount of excitement as there would be over a horse race, you know. There'd be tremendous excitement over the horse race, but there wasn't much excitement over that. You get tired of it, or I got tired of it anyway, looking at it anyway.
The winner was Camille Janazzi in 6 hours, 39 minutes, at an average speed of 49.2 miles per hour. The official results published the following day show that the French cars had been the most impressive, Deniff and Farmont finishing second and third on Panhards, and Gabriel being fourth on Amours. Edge, the only other finisher, was disqualified for getting a push at one of the controls. What was the Mercedes like that won? Frank Smith, having driven an identical car over the same course in this year's rally, had this to say.
Well, it was very advanced design, because most cars of this age had automatic inlet valves, which means the inlet valves were opened by the suction of the piston. But this one had mechanically operated inlet valves, overhead inlet valves, and side exhaust valves. There's no fan. It was Mercedes' patented radiator. It was the first of the honeycomb radiators. There's a pump, of course, a circulating pump. This is the low-tension magneto. This is an interesting little thing. If I shut this side of the bonnet down and we go around the other side, I'll show you. This camshaft here works the sparking plugs. And these are the sparking plugs here. And you see this lever moving up and down. The sparking plugs actually contact inside the cylinder. This device here pressurizes the petrol tank to bring the fuel up to the engine, and it pressurizes it with exhaust gas, which you might think is dangerous, but there's a gauze flame trap in there. Well, these are modern tyres. They're built in the old molds, but, that one's still warm there. Now, they were working on canvas tyres, and canvas tyres had woven canvas in them, as the description says. And this used to fret and fray, and eventually the strands would break and you get a blown-out tyre. Well, there were cars just as fast as this, you know. The Napier was as fast as this, in fact, probably faster. It's very difficult to say what the value of it is. It's priceless, really, because there are only three of them in the world, and I would say that this is the most original of the three. The other two have been very much modified. But Janazzi was a very crafty driver, and he let all the other fellows break down, and then he carried on and won the race. And he won it, I think, at 49 miles an hour or thereabouts. To average 49 miles an hour, you've got to go fairly fast. But I don't think he was pushing the car to full stretch. As you've seen just with the short ride, a brave man and a smooth road, I should think with downhill you could probably hit 100.
Janazzi, who was 32 at the time of the race, is said to have earned £8,000 for his win. Ironically, he was to die a few years later, shot by his friends as a result of a practical joke. The race was over. Now there was no further use for the enormous grandstand at Ballyshannon. The dismantling of it brought an unexpected bonus to one of the workers, James O'Rourke.
I was at the loading of it. Oh, they were loading it. They had two big trawlers behind this big engine, two big wagons, like. And they were nearly 2 days loading. And there was a weak spot in the road this time, and didn't the big wheel go down it? And, of course, the big wheel kept spinning and sat on the firebox of the engine. There was three lads on it. And they went down to the shop. I don't know how they got word now, but a man come with a car, a small little car, and was me and another chap on the cross. And he stopped asking, where was the curragh? And we said, we'd show him. And we wanted the drive, because we never got to drive in the car, do you see? So I got into the front with him, with the driver, and the chap that was with me was named John Robertson. He used to work up the road here. And he got into the seat behind. And we went on, and when we were going through Martinstown, there was a bridge across the road, do you see? The bridge at that time would be up like that, now they're all leveled. And he was going so hard, we thought. When he went over the bridge, didn't the bottom of it kick up and the lad behind come in on top of it? Robertson. I think we had to stop and push him out. He got in, you know, that his hands went down between the toes. So we got afraid then the way he was going to come with the lad, you see. We said he's driving too hard. And there's a shop over here called The Bush. You see, it'd be about a mile and a half from the corner. So we he wanted to go into the shop. So we didn't want to go to the shop at all because we had no money. You see, we only wanted the day out. And we had to walk by 3 miles ground, nearly. We walked by, and we were laughing at one another.
The race stimulated a new interest in motoring. From that time, the number and the range of models imported into Ireland dramatically increased, several examples of which were seen at this year's rally.
1908's Gat. 20 horsepower. Made in Italy. It's supposed to have been a copy of the Mercedes at that time. Got that outside Strad Valley here, locally. And it was completely disintegrated. In other words, I had to rebuild the wheels, the lot.
It's an Argyle. It had only one owner before. And he was a Major Jordan in Mayo. And I purchased it from him. It had done 200,000 miles, they estimated, then. Well, I hope to average 25. She'll do 35. But you don't push these old ladies too hard.
Preservation of the old cars. Preservation and restoration is the principal thing that we... It's the whole idea of the club. And the rally is secondary. And the other principal idea is not to let any cars out of the country.
I see them going twice as hard by now, never worried at all about it. You wouldn't see them, but you would see them playing that time.